Hi, this is Greg Rempe, host of the Barbecue Central Show, and you're listening to the Baseball and BBQ Podcast with your hosts, Jeff the Old Coot Cohen and Leonard Hollywood Aberman.
Baseball and BBQ on Long Island, New York. This is episode number 217 of Baseball and BBQ. I'm Jeff the Oku Cohen. That over there is Len Hollywood Aberman. We welcome you back to our show, Leonard.
Jeff, episode 217, as we enter year 7, there's one thing I've got to tell you.
What's that?
The studios that you speak of, we could use a new coat of paint.
Probably.
I mean, come on. 7 years and we have yet to paint. All right. Get the painters in here. Let's spruce it up a little bit. And let's get episode number 217, year 7 started. How are we going to do that?
With the author of Smart, Wrong, and Lucky, Jonathan Mayo, talks about how the recruiting or the scouting process takes place in baseball. It is a fascinating look into the world of scouts.
Yes, it is. We'll talk about that. And then we've got Dave Williamson, who is known all over the place as Meet Dave. He's got a podcast. He has his comedy. But before we get to either of those guests, it's time to tell everyone that all the major sports are in action this week, with the college football playoffs ready to kick off. BetOnline is your number one destination for all your sports wagering information, including news for pro football, the NBA, upcoming fights, and NHL games this season. Head to the website today to get into the action and see all the updated odds for the week. Remember to use promo code BLEAV, that's B-L-E-A-V, to receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet online. It is where the game starts. So, Jeff, you were talking about the book Smart, Wrong, and Lucky, The Origin Stories of Baseball's Unexpected Stars by Jonathan Mayo, right? Every time we have an author on and they have a book on something that I was like, oh, that's a great idea. And you think, what else could they write about? There can't be anything more. And here we go. Because people don't, you know, you hear about scouts all the time. You hear about players that, you know, they end their career or they don't make it to the majors or whatever, and they go into scouting or whatever. You hear about this guy was a diamond in the rough and he was found by this scout or whatever. It's all in this book.
And it's amazing how teams are getting rid of scouts, or at least, you know, having less in them, because they are a phenomenal part of the game. These are the guys who go out and find these players.
Right.
And, you know, one thing that analytics can't do is can't measure heart. You got to watch that.
You get these guys out there. They know what they're looking at. The real good ones, they're some of them are looking at high school players. You know, forget college. I mean, they're looking at high school players. How do you figure out that a high school player is going to become this big star, or even forget big star? You know, they all want to find that big star. But what about just the everyday player? It's not easy to find.
No,
guys,
not
are
at all.
The best, right?
They are.
So to be able to, you know, even a regular everyday second baseman, let's say for the Minnesota Twins, right? Who maybe he's decent, but you got to find that person.
And this is what these scouts do. So let's take a listen to Jonathan Mayo with Smart, Wrong, and Lucky.
Baseball and barbecue listeners, you know how we feel about authors. We love them. We welcome them on the show. We're so glad that they come on. And you guys are in for a big treat, because the author that we have tonight is Jonathan Mayo. His book is called Smart, Wrong, and Lucky, The Origin Stories of Baseball's Unexpected Stars. And let me just read a tiny bit of the inside jacket. A fascinating look at how MLB teams find diamonds in the rough. In the plainest of terms, baseball scouts are tasked with seeing the future, a distant future at that. Baseball's long developmental arc leaves room for plenty of twists and turns on the way to the show. Some prospects shoot like arrows toward their projected potential, while others fizzle out or chart an unexpected course. Smart, Wrong, and Lucky explores how first impressions measure up to their aftermaths, the draft, years of progression, and for a talented few, major league success. Our guest, as I said, is the author Jonathan Mayo. He has been a writer for MLB.com since 1999, focusing on the Major League Baseball draft and minor league prospects since 2003. This is his second book, but this is the first time we're having him on, and we're very excited. Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us on Baseball and Barbecue.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, that's all the time we have, so thank you very much,
Emily. All right, great. That was easy. Thanks.
That was, you know,
buy the book, everybody.
Buy the book.
Jonathan, I really enjoyed this book. I mean, it was such a fascinating look into the world of scouting. And I have obviously a lot of questions for you, but this book focuses really on 8 players, and we're not going to get through them because we want people to buy the book. But there's some terms in here that I didn't understand when reading it. And could you explain? I mean, we all know what a scout is, but I never really understood what a cross-checker does. Could you explain that?
Sure. So there's sort of a hierarchy of scouts, and it starts with the area scout, and he's dedicated to a specific region. Sometimes it's just a state. Sometimes it's multiple states. You know, if it's, you know, an area that doesn't have as much talent, sometimes one state has several area scouts. You know, California, obviously not one, you know, one person can't cover it. They're the ones who are responsible for being the first line of defense, so to speak, where they identify talent and they file reports. The next tier up is what's called a regional cross-checker. And typically teams will have 3 or 4 of them, you know, geographically. So like a West Coast cross-checker, based on the recommendations of the area scout, will come in and see players up and down the West Coast, Southern California, Northern California. That includes Oregon, Washington. It might include Arizona, you know, all those 4 corner states as well, you know, regionally. Then the tier above the regional cross checker is the national cross checker. And that's the guy who zooms around the country. If a area scout and a regional cross checker like a guy, then typically the national cross checker will go and see him. And the national cross checker is one sort of tier below the scouting director, who is the decision maker. And you know, the scouting director doesn't have time to see every single player that they want to see. They will obviously see guys that they're considering for their first round pick, and will invariably see guys they have interest in over the first several rounds. But at a certain point in the draft, it really kind of turns to the work that the area scouts and maybe the regional cross checkers have done, because the higher level evaluators don't have time to see all those players. And of course, all of this fits under the umbrella of the general manager, mm-hmm. who, especially for that first round pick, it can often be the one who makes the ultimate decision.
Jonathan, baseball fans are going to love this book because it talks about things that we always hear about. Oh, this guy was scouted and this guy was picked in this round, and this guy is projected to be a star and this guy wasn't. And now we get to be part of how all of that decision making comes about. And I loved it. And one of the things that one of the players you feature in the book is Jacob DeGrom. And Jacob DeGrom, injuries aside, one of the best pitchers that we've seen in recent years, starts out as a shortstop. That's fascinating in itself. And I'll let you talk on that in a second. But when I saw that Davey Johnson was, you know, you wonder, like, where did Davey Johnson go? Davey Johnson, manager of the 1986 World Champion Mets, had DeGrom on a team and then didn't let him, you know, play shortstop and pitch. And take us into that chapter, because it's fascinating.
So Jacob DeGrom fancied himself a shortstop. If anyone who followed him with the Mets, you know, he loved to hit back when, you know, pitchers were allowed to do so. And, you know, I think I didn't get a chance to talk to Jacob. He's kind of a private guy. He doesn't like talking about himself. But I think if you were to ask him, he probably still thinks that he could have made it as a shortstop. But he couldn't hit in college very, very well, but he was a really good defender. In his sophomore year of college, I think he pitched once or twice in relief, and then went to the fledgling Florida Collegiate League, where his manager was Davey Johnson. And the funny thing is that DeGrom had agreed to pitch a little bit for that team, but wanted to play shortstop. And when it became clear that they had another sort of primary guy at short and Davey wanted him to pitch, he quit. And as Davey told me for the book, he's like, I don't blame him. Like, he thought that's what he wanted to do. And then, you know, fast forward to the next spring, and he started as Stetson's closer, because then he could still play the field every day. But it became pretty clear that he was the best pitcher on the staff. And so they moved him into the rotation, and they kind of, I won't say he took off from there, because not that many teams noticed him. He didn't throw very hard at the time, but he was very athletic and could throw strikes. And it was really the previous year, that brief look, and then in the fall, that the Mets area scouts in Florida kind of noticed, boy, it really, it's easy. You know, it's funny, you know, now looking back, he's had so many injury issues, but it was so athletic and easy, and he could put the ball on the dime without working on it. And so they knew that there was some upside there, but, you know, it's not like they took him in the second round, right? They took him in, I think it was the ninth round. Yeah. You know, so, but guys like that who don't throw very hard have a hard time getting noticed.
Hey, let me dispel some myth here. Now, Jacob DeGrom, he was both a pitcher and a shortstop in college, because people think he just, you know, once he was converted to pitcher, that he gave up shortstop. That's not the case.
No, he did both up until the point he was drafted. Now, when he moved into their starting rotation, they wouldn't let him play shortstop as much, because they obviously wanted to protect his arm. So he ended up being their Friday night starter, which is the ace of a college staff. So I think Saturdays he wouldn't play. Maybe he would DH. But by Sunday, he was largely back at shortstop, and they had a midweek game. He would play shortstop because at the time he wanted to help the team, but he wasn't keen on thinking of himself as a pitcher. It wasn't until, you know, the Mets showed interest and took him that he, you know, sort of changed the focus of his baseball career that way.
And you mentioned he was a Friday night starter. So it sounds like that college pitchers pitch once a week. And Friday night was the showcase game, I guess, for scouts and people who come see them. When they get to the majors, it's now a five-man rotation. So they pitch every fifth day. So, you know, I'm trying to equate that to the pitchers coming home from Japan, where in college it's once a week. In Japan, it's once a week. Now they come into the major leagues. They both, for some reason, Japanese pitchers can't adjust to that five-man rotation. It's just very strange.
You know, keep in mind that any college pitcher, even an advanced one, gets some time in the minor leagues to try to adjust to that. And, you know, hopefully they're either so good that they figure it out faster, or they get a year or two to kind of adjust to that new routine of pitching every fifth day instead of once a week. But I think that's why a lot of the time you see college pitchers, or even high school pitchers, right at first, their stuff will back up a little bit. You know, they don't throw as hard because they're not used to throwing every fifth day. And then, I mean, Jacob DeGrom was a weird case, because he signed and he blew out his elbow that first summer. And then it was like a year later, he came back And, you know, as I said in the book, they started getting calls, like the guys who were responsible for drafting him was like, or just in general, Omar Minaya, who was no longer the general manager, but he was like, hey, who's this guy that you got throwing 98, you know, down in A ball? And they're like, Jacob DeGrom, like, because he was 89 to 91.
Right.
So clearly he worked hard during his rehab to build up the rest of his body because he knew he was focused on just the one thing. He didn't, you know, he didn't need to stay as lithe and you know, as you would to be a shortstop. He didn't lose his athleticism, but, you know, he worked on his lower half and things like that. And that led to the increased velocity. And you see that sometimes, but often, especially right in the onset of transitioning to pro ball, the stuff will back up a little bit until they kind of figure out the routine and what you need to do to maintain strength and add it.
Let's talk about scouts for a second. You know, you get the feeling that a lot of these scouts, they tried to keep these players secret. You know, they didn't want anyone else to, and I can understand that. They find someone, they don't want them stolen from them and all that. Because it's no longer the days of, you know, you see the person, you make them an offer, and they come play for your team. You've got rounds and numbers and who goes first and picks in the order. A scout, a top scout, what kind of salary can a top scout make in baseball?
You know, I'm not 100% sure on that now. I noticed recently I saw a listing for an area scout, again, lowest rung, starting is somewhere around, you know, between $50,000 and $70,000 a year starting. And that depends, you know, and some of it depends on where in the country you are. And so obviously and that was for, you know, someone just starting out. I think it was a Northeast scout, and they're not going to get paid the same as someone in Southern California. And large, you know, often the guys in Southern California have previous experience, and like with all professions, right? The more experience you have, the more money you can make, and on up. I mean, I think once you get up to being a scouting director, you do pretty well, but I don't actually know what the salary range is.
Okay.
Beyond that.
And then as far as scouts, and they're making picks, and some of them, like in the book, you've got Albert Pujols, you got DeGrom, you have, you know, Shane Bieber.
You're thinking Justin Bieber, but it's Shane Bieber.
Yeah. Bieber, right? Because he sings and he plays baseball.
Sure,
but yeah, I mean, so you've got some. I mean, the players that you mention in here are well known players. Are the scouts, you know, rated on their ability to pick these guys? Like, is the guy that picked Albert Pujols, is he set for life? Like, they look at him like, wow, he's got the Midas touch.
No. I mean, I think that's where the lucky part comes in the title. Because obviously there's a lot of smart, but there's a lot of guessing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact of the matter is with Albert Pujols, the area scout a few years later found himself out of a job because overall, I think he wasn't evaluated as being that good of a scout. Now, you know, it's a results-oriented business, so you need to produce big leaguers. But sometimes it's also just about producing good professionals, because you never know what's going to happen. The one thing I don't tackle in the book at all is what happens on the player development side, because the scouts may identify, oh, this guy has talent and thinks he's got the kind of makeup he's going to work hard. But it's such a hard sport. I think it's like, you know, 1% of players who enter pro ball ever make it to the major leagues. So I think it's really identifying players who maximize what they're able to do. And the vast majority of them never make it to the major league. So it's kind of a hard thing to quantify, like, well, what makes a good scout? Now, I think the ones who are really, really good and move up to the different rungs are very good at identifying talent. And then, you know, to be a scouting director, you need to exhibit certain leadership skills and ability to organize a department and things of that nature. And that comes with time, but it's a tough thing to sort of say, like, well, yeah, you better get X amount of big leaguers every year. Otherwise, you know, you're not going to be successful, because it is such a crazy crapshoot in terms of evaluating amateur talent.
You know, you made a great point saying, you know, only very few 1% make it to the major leagues. And, you know, people think, fans, they think, oh, this guy stinks. This guy, you make it to the major leagues. I mean, you don't stink. I mean, even the 25th, 26th guy on the roster, he's probably the best guy in his town or his state or something, because it has to be a tremendous amount of talent to actually make it to the major leagues. What I found fascinating in the book is on draft day, where they have all the discussions going on, you know, the first 10 rounds. Now, your book focuses on these guys who were really picked in the lower rounds. And then there was the infighting. Oh, got to pick my guy, got to pick this guy. I know that happened with Joey Votto and things like that. You want to talk about what happens in the draft room when the scouts get together on draft day?
Yeah, I mean, it varies. And, you know, not every area scout goes to every draft. And depending on how long you've been there, can you speak up? You know, as the draft goes on, as I mentioned, the lower level scouts have more to say. And if there's a guy they really believe in, they'll start kind of pounding the table more for a guy that they want to take. You know, I think one of the best examples is in the Mookie Betts chapter, where, you know, the area scout had strong conviction. And, you know, there was a higher up guy, but it was new to the organization, and Tommy Allison, who was a very well-regarded scout, he's been a scouting director, he'd done lots of things, but he was new there, and so he had to try to find the right way, because he'd not been in a draft room with them before. So you can't just come in all hot, because that might turn the scouting director off. So it was this kind of like, hey, maybe we need to take him now. And Amiel Sade, who was the scouting director at the time, said in retrospect, like, I was an idiot, like going back and rereading the reports, like, why didn't I take him sooner? We got lucky that we got him when we did, in the fifth or sixth round. So I think it really depends on the personalities. You need to know what the scouting director is going to be okay with. You know, typically the area scout can't go directly to the scouting director. So hopefully you have someone else in the room who, you know, who believes in the guy. You know, with Jacob deGrom, it helped that the area scout was backed up by Steve Barmingham, who was the Mets regional cross checker at the time. So you had multiple scouts, you know, and when that happens, then maybe the scouting director's more likely to pay attention. But then it's also a game of like, well, when can we get a guy? How long can we wait? You know, does the area scout have a good feel for other teams that are interested? So all of those dynamics and variables come into play.
Yeah, it's like you could have there's some, you pick them in a later round, you might lose them. You don't know if you're going to get them. But with Mookie Betts, you mentioned in the book something that's interesting. I think I had heard this somewhere else, but he has another skill. He's quite the bowler, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he could probably hit the professional bowling tour if he wanted to. He's one of those guys that I get the sense that if he really wanted to focus on anything, and right. he was a good basketball player, mm-hmm. he could have played college basketball. You know, not big enough. Just one of these guys who has so much ability, both physically and mentally, the hand-eye coordination, all of it, and that's, you know, the Red Sox saw that more than any other team. There were, you know, a couple other teams that were interested, you know, as is often the case, but I don't think the Red Sox would have gotten him if they had tried to push that off for another round.
And actually there's, you mentioned, you know, being good at other sports. There is a player in here that you mentioned, and I forget which one it is, that the reason he went into baseball was he did not make his high school basketball team.
That's Lorenzo Cain.
Yes.
Yeah, that's, you know, I don't like to pick like a favorite. It's like picking who your favorite kid is. But that one is the most, like, sounds like it could be a Disney movie story of all these. Yes. And all these are amazing against all odds stories. But yes, he wasn't allowed to play football. Kudos to Lorenzo Cain's mom. Mm-hmm. Tried out for the basketball team and got cut. Anyone who saw Lorenzo Cain play Major League Baseball, I'm like, this was a small high school in Florida. How he didn't make the basketball team, I don't care if he couldn't shoot. I mean, just, he's so athletic, you know, 40-inch whatever vertical leap, wingspan. I'm like, how is he not on a basketball team? But thank goodness, right? Because if he makes his high school basketball team, he probably never plays baseball. He didn't play an inning of baseball until his sophomore year of high school. And then the Brewers drafted him 2 years later, waited to sign him. You could wait back then almost a full year, sent him to junior college, and then signed him. And then that summer he was the rookie league, the Arizona League MVP, and was off and running from there. But yeah, that's a unbelievable. Like if someone told you that story, you'd think they were making it up.
Yeah, you actually start the chapter as you say, it's like you have filmmaker, executive, mm-hmm. like it is a movie that they're going to make.
Right. So. And you'd get laughed out of the pitch room because they'd be like, I'm sorry, that no one would believe that.
That was the most fascinating chapter, I thought. Again, another term that you explain in the book is the draft and follow, which I don't think a lot of people understand what that means. And if you can explain it, that'd be sure. Fantastic.
I mean, Lorenzo Cain is the best example of that, you know, in the book. And they kind of have brought it back now, but the draft is so different. But back then, you could draft a player. The draft was in June. And you would have until the following May, like a week before the next year's draft, to sign a player. A lot of teams would use the draft and follow for high-end kind of raw high school players. Pitchers more often than not, but not always, obviously, but like Lorenzo Cain being the prime example. We're really interested in this guy. We're going to draft him late, but we're not quite sure that he's ready. He couldn't go on to a four-year college. You go to a four-year school, you got to wait until he's 21 to redraft him, but you retain his rights if he goes to junior college. Then you can go and see him play against much better competition and make an evaluation as to whether or not you want to sign him. Sometimes teams would talk a guy out of going to like a high level 4-year school. It's like, hey, go to a year of junior college. We'll see how it goes. Cause we may, and then they'll get paid even more. Lorenzo Cain was a 17th round pick and he was so raw, but the Brewers scout was so smart and saw something that like, listen, it's worth a shot. And he struggled at first in junior college and then kind of came on. And that's when they realized they needed to sign him. He would have just gone back to junior college for another year, but he would have reentered the draft and anyone could have taken him. And the Brewers didn't want that to happen.
We are talking to Jonathan Mayo. The book is Smart, Wrong, and Lucky: The Origin Stories of Baseball's Unexpected Stars. And it starts with a player who I believe did they just release him or right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The Reds just released, right? But possibly a potential Hall of Famer, Joey Votto. How did you decide who was the first player you were going to open the book with?
Not entirely my decision. The editors had some say in that. I had no problem with opening with him. And they basically didn't. His contract was up. And
right.
I think there was a little bit of a mutual decision there, and I don't know if he's going to play anymore. Maybe he'll play for Toronto. He's from there. It was a good chapter to start with, just because even though he wasn't like the late round pick, it was such an interesting story of the Reds scouts hiding Joey Votto.
Yes,
you couldn't do that now,
right?
They couldn't. You can't hide players from other teams as much, let alone. I mean, they were hiding the player from their own general manager because they knew that they would get leaked to other teams. And those guys, and Casey McKeon, who was the scouting director, and John Castleberry, who was the kind of jack of all trades, in effect, a cross checker. And he's now a terrific national cross checker. And Casey McKeon works for the Washington Nationals. That's Jack McKeon's son, by the way.
Right. Son of Trader Jack.
They lost their jobs because of that, but they had so much conviction in Joey Votto that they thought it was worth it, and they were right.
Joey Votto was a Canadian who didn't like hockey.
He was all baseball all the time. It's even the Canadians who play baseball tend to also have played hockey, and it just was not. He was always all about baseball and just was not. He didn't go to a ton of showcases. Nowadays, the Canadian national team, those guys don't get seen as much, but they'll take the junior national team will take a trip down to Florida. So they get seen there. They'll go to more of those summer showcase things. He didn't have the financial resources to do all the things. And I think now there are enough organizations that help players that can't afford to do it to get seen more. And there's more video that everyone can see. So a guy who can hit like that, it's much less likely that you're going to have that kind of under the radar story that that turned out to be.
Exactly. Yeah. And you talk about the showcase leagues. I mean, we all know about the Cape Cod League, which is the most famous one, but they also, you also mentioned about other regional leagues with the Woodbat League, when they go, I guess they go from metal bats to wood bats, and to get more exposure to more scouts. So you want to talk about how that process works?
Yeah. I mean, the Cape Cod League is the sort of standard bearer, right? That's the elite level wood bat league. And, you know, the biggest thing it does is help scouts, because as good as they are, I still marvel at their ability to be like, well, this guy can hit with metal, but he's not going to hit with wood, you know? And sometimes, you know, they evaluate the swing path and the mechanics and is it strength over bat speed and that sort of thing. But it's a much different thing to be able to impact the ball with wood. So the more often you can see a player swing a wood bat, the better. And there are other, you know, there are many other wood bat leagues on the college level. I think the Northwoods League is one that I mentioned. I think it was the Jayhawk League. Was that the one that Albert Pujols went to?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
There are a bunch of them. The Florida Collegiate League was a wood bat league. And then in the high school, all those summer showcase things, Perfect Game National, East Coast Pro Showcase, the area code games, all of them got mentioned at various times. Those are all wood bat also. And nowadays, you know, players are so used to it that they'll take batting practice for scouts with wood so they can see it. So that's kind of narrowed the gap in terms of trying to figure out, not to mention that now in the amateur game, especially in college, they use those composite bats, which are a little bit closer to wood and how they work and the kind of action you see with the ball coming off the bat. It's not quite the same as the back in the day when it was the sort of more pure aluminum, quote unquote, ping ball, where the ball flew out of all the college ballparks because you're hitting with metal.
Yeah.
The image that many people have, at least, that, you know, maybe it's from movies, I don't know, but is the grizzled old veteran, you know, who comes around to the game and is like, you gotta see this guy pitch, you know. That's not how scouting is, right? These guys are not, they've got their radar guns, they've got their, it's very sophisticated. These guys are not, they're not the grizzled old veterans, are they?
Well, those guys still exist. You know, mm-hmm. But yeah, I think this sort of thought that everyone is Clint Eastwood from Trouble with the Curve. It's not true. And, you know, not only do they all have radar guns, but you see the advancements in the game at the major league level in terms of data and analytics and all the advanced statistics that has seeped down to all levels of the game. And the more data you can have, the better. You know, I think what happens is that, or the problem arises when you go too far in one direction, right? The old grizzled scouts are like, I'm not going to look at any of the data. Like that's terrible. And what happens more often now is the pendulum going too far the other way, where you think, well, I don't need scouts to watch a player. I can just use it, you know, use the data or look at video or things like that. And I think the ones who do it right use all of it. You need to use all the tools because it's so hard to evaluate players at any level, but especially high school and college players. And forget about the, you know, international players. You're watching a 15-year-old Dominican kid and trying to figure out what he's going to look like when he's 24. I'm like, I don't understand how you do that, but without the data, because there's not as much of it. So I think, you know, you need to use all the tools handed to you. And, you know, I think nowadays, the guys who come into scouting now, and I shouldn't say guys, the men and women, there are some women scouts, but who come into the game now, you need to have at least some feel for data, even if you understand the importance of hitting the road and seeing the players, because you need to see them play games and whether they have a feel for playing the game. So it's kind of a hybrid approach is what I strongly advocate for.
Yeah, you mentioned something just now that just triggered something. You mentioned that the Dominican, the kids in the Dominican, 16 years old, 15, 16 years old, they're getting mega million contracts. We're seeing Jason Dominguez of the Yankees, Alvarez of the Mets, and they were kids when they were being, I guess, scouted. I mean, looked at, but they were signing big contracts at that time.
Yep. I mean, and they, you know, I think the Major League Baseball has tried to kind of level the playing field there, because that they used to have teams with hide players and you know, they discover guys, and part of that was fun, but now they have a lot more showcases and events and things like that. So they have some data, you know, in terms of, you know, even having some exit velocity data of a young kid can be a predictor, you know, so mm-hmm. it's still a remarkable, I mean, it is, that is an amazing leap of faith, you know, to paying a guy any amount, whether it's millions of dollars, sure, but like, you know, millions of dollars, thousands of dollars to get a sense that that player is going to be a major leaguer is amazing to me. And, you know, I think it's still amazing, you know, here in the States from high school baseball and even college baseball, even though that, you know, it's taking guys less time to get to the big leagues and the game is skewing younger. I think that's great. I think it shows that, you know, the industry as a whole, both on the scouting and the player development side, are doing a much better job of identifying the talent and then helping that talent develop into the next wave of major league stars.
Jonathan, you are actually involved with talking about minor league players in your regular job, right, with MLB.com. Tell us a little bit about when you're not writing these incredible books, what you do for a living.
Yeah, I mean, that's where the book sort of came from, because I spent so much time talking to scouts. So since 2003, as you mentioned, I've kind of been focusing on minor league prospects and the baseball draft. You know, anyone who comes to MLB.com and sees the top 100 prospects list or the top 250 draft lists, you know, top 30 for each team, I have my hands in all of those, not all 30 teams, but there's a group of us that, you know, a group of three of us that do all 30 teams that we split. So I'm talking to scouts all the time for that content, and then any like stories that I write and things of that nature. And it was actually during the pandemic, I decided to do a story. It was like an oral history on Charlie Blackmon, how he was scouted, because I happened to be talking to a scout who didn't sign him. And that's the funny thing, is like scouts like to talk about the guys they missed on as much as the guys that they hit on. And I'm fascinated by the guys that they were sure were going to be good, who were first round picks who didn't make it. But, you know, while I'm not a marketing genius, I knew that a book with a cover of players that never made it to the major leagues, people aren't necessarily going to want to buy that one. So, but I was talking to the scout, Brian Bridges. He's now the scouting director for the Kansas City Royals. He was an area scout. He was the one who started telling me the story about Charlie Blackmon. I'm like, oh, I'm going to do a story on that for MLB.com. And as I dug into that and ended up talking to a bunch, you know, a few different scouts about it, I'm like, you know, every scout has stories like this. Brian himself, who's a great storyteller, had several, some of which didn't fit for what I was doing. But I'm like, I bet you there, yeah, I could do more of these. And sure enough, I mean, I could do, you know, a sequel, you know, as quickly as I feel ready to want to write another book. So it really stemmed directly from the work that I do day to day for MLB.com.
You must spend a lot of time in minor league stadiums or going around to college stadiums. So tell us about your, you know, what you do during the year. I know you just explained that, but do you travel around
the country? Yeah, not as much as I would like, just because there's so much to do on the day to day, like maintaining those lists and things like that. Every year I say I'm going to try to get to more. I mean, I've been to Mary Fisher, and I go to spring training every year. I go to the Arizona Fall League for a couple weeks every year. And then here and there, I'll try to get to minor league parks. I'm actually hoping, starting next spring, to start work on a slightly different project, which will take me regularly to different minor league cities, like, and spending like a week there to kind of digging into what the community is like and things like that. So I am hoping, I always love going, and I wish I had more time to do that, but I'm only one person and I can't be everywhere all the time.
Well, I got to tell you, if people want to see scouts, go to any minor league ballpark. They're right behind home plate with those radar guns. I mean, I saw them in Brooklyn. Actually, I see them out in ISOP for the Independent League Long Island Ducks.
Sure.
They're out there.
They all get scouted. Yeah. I mean, because you see indie ball guys get signed all the time.
Jonathan, who is, I guess you mentioned your editor before that had some influence in the book. Unless you had the exact number of interviews and players in the book, there must have been one player that ended up on the cutting room floor.
The only one who really sort of ended up on the, and I wouldn't even say ended up on the cutting room floor, I kind of made the decision to focus on drafted players because that's really where my focus is. But I had started to do research on Ronald Acuna, and because he only signed for $100,000, which based on who he is now is the, you know, one of the bargains and all bargains.
Right.
And I did one interview with Rolando Pino, I think is his name, the scout who was the most responsible for signing him. And I was like, you know, I think this will be a good chapter. One of the problems I had is that, you know, the other people who were involved in the Braves organization were those who ended up out of work because of their international signing issues. Mm-hmm. So it's harder to get people. And I don't speak Spanish. You know, the signing scout spoke English, so that was fine. So I had the basis of what could have been an okay chapter, but I didn't have enough for me. There weren't as many people involved. You know, some of these chapters you guys read, I've talked to 7 or 8 people.
Right. Sure.
And I decided, like, you know what, let me focus sort of on the draft. I'm much more familiar with that process and how that works. So he's the one guy who ended up not doing. I think lots of other players got brought up, but I didn't really dive into as a chapter. I mean, Brian Bridges told me the story of Buster Posey, who ended up being, you know, he was the number 5 overall pick in the draft, so he didn't really fit. But, you know, when he was coming out of high school, everyone thought he was a pitcher. He was a kind of touch and feel, Greg Maddux light, kind of like really knew what he was doing, had never caught an inning, you know. And the story that Ryan told me about Buster is that even though he only saw him as a pitcher on his East Coast Pro Showcase team, he was the best pitcher, but he sent them up to pinch hit in their big game against the Florida team, and he hit a bases loaded clearing double, and yet he still couldn't shake the idea that, oh, he's a pitcher. He was drafted late, didn't sign, went on, and it wasn't until Mike Martin got his hands on him at Florida State that he put him behind the plate. Even in Florida State, he moved around a lot. But, you know, that happened a lot, you know, in the Charlie Blackman chapter. I think we talk about that sort of familiarity bias, and the Rockies area scout Alan Matthews had never seen him as a pitcher. But everyone else in the area, because Charlie was from Georgia, thought of him as a failed left-handed pitcher who got hurt.
Right.
And
yeah,
he couldn't look past the fact, even though he hit like 400 in his senior year of college. But, you know, these are humans, right? And so they couldn't look past the fact that Charlie Blackman should have been a hitter and was a hitter, obviously.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that, because I wonder, like, is there a player who, you know, had a great career as a position player and maybe in another parallel universe may have been a great pitcher? Because it's amazing to me how these scouts, they see these players. I mean, look at DeGrom, right? Was a shortstop, but they saw him as a pitcher. These other guys, it's not even just you're watching the guy for, you know, what he's doing, but now you're thinking, even though he's catching, he might be a good second baseman or something. That's an amazing talent.
Sure. I mean, Craig Biggio, right? He was an all-star as a catcher and as a second baseman and as a center fielder. Now that's an aberration, but I mean, you have a lot of guys who started out as catchers and then got moved. You know, Will Myers was a catcher. Yeah. Bryce Harper was a catcher as an amateur. Yeah. Sometimes their bat's so good, you don't want them to get ruined. But like, I mean, the short answer is yes. There are countless guys who made it as one thing and could have very easily done the other thing, you know, and sometimes you wonder, especially like the hitters who don't quite make it or make it for a little bit. And you're like, wait, maybe they should try putting him on the mound, because he was a pretty good pitcher back in the day, and the arm strength is there. Could they figure it out?
What about, of course, his name escapes me, but remember, he was a pitcher. Then all of a sudden, he couldn't find the plate.
Rick ended Ankiel.
Right, Ankiel.
Yeah.
Became, you know, I mean, he did both. Well, not at the same time, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, Sean Doolittle, who pitched for a number of years, you know, as a reliever in the big leagues, mm-hmm. was a two-way player at the University of Virginia and was originally drafted as a hitter, and then had lots of like knee and other kind of issues. So then they put him on the mound, and he ended up pitching for, I don't know, 10 years in the big leagues.
It's so funny, Jonathan.
It happens all the time.
It's funny you just mentioned him, because we just had on last night, we spoke
Trevor May.
Trevor May, who retired and used Sean Doolittle's line in his retirement, what he wrote out. And we spoke to him about that, the fact that he used Sean Doolittle's line. And it was something like, I'm sorry that I made everyone nervous when I went out there. I was nervous, too.
Right.
And Trevor May loved that line. But Sean Doolittle, who just, you know, had retired recently.
One of the best.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. If you're going to quote somebody, Sean Doolittle's a good guy to quote.
Yeah. So it's just everything's connected. I love that, too, about baseball, too, is everything is connected.
Absolutely.
Well, Jonathan, we appreciate your time. I have one more question before we wrap up. The book is called Smart, Wrong, and Lucky, The Origin Stories of Baseball's Unexpected Stars. The foreword is by Dave Dombrowski. But I wanted to ask you about Albert Pujols. Two things that I took from Albert Pujols is his loyalty and his maturity in the scouting process. I thought that was fantastic. And if you want to just touch a little bit upon Albert Pujols' maturity and loyalty, that'd be great.
It's kind of amazing, because I mean, he was by far and away the best. I mean, he's the best player of the generation, the best player in that draft, and no one wanted him, you know. And some of it's timing, you know. The one other team that was interested in him was, you know, the Tampa Bay Rays and their area scout, and they kept sending in cross checkers, and they didn't see him good, you know. And he was never good in front of a large group of people, except like once. And he, you know, one of the things that, you know, people have told me, some of it didn't even make it into the chapters, like just he was a man amongst boys, both physically, but also how he presented himself. You know, he was taking care of a child with special needs at a very, very young age and took that responsibility very seriously. So he, like, when he was in junior college, he didn't live with the players. You know, not because he was standoffish, but he was living with a woman, and he was an adult while they were kids at this junior college. And I feel like he sort of handled all of that with a tremendous amount of grace, because there was a lot of things, and I couldn't get to it in the book because I think it was a little too fraught. It was a little too difficult. But the fact that there was this Dominican kid who showed up in the Midwest, I think area scouts didn't know how to evaluate him, because he was so big, you know, all these crazy rumors about his age for a long period of time, which have been debunked, but people still kind of believe. I'm like, all right, if you believe that, then he was playing really good baseball when he was like 47 years old, or, you know, however old they think he is. I'm like, that's absurd. And I'm sure there was some bitterness. You know, he talked a lot about sort of having this chip and wanting to prove everybody wrong, including the people within the organization. But the people who believed in him, you know, that the Rays scout who ended up working for the Cardinals was like a father figure to him. You know, I think that meant the world to him, because not that many people believed in him as much as he believed in himself.
Yeah. Well, the book is a fascinating look into the world of scouting and these players. And it was fantastic talking to you, Jonathan. He can be reached at or followed at on Twitter or X or whatever it's called, at Jonathan Mayo. Any other, and you can purchase the book anywhere.
Anywhere.
So if you want to give it's by Triumph Books. You can get on their website or Amazon or anywhere you want. It's a fantastic book, and recommend it to everybody.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Jonathan. I say this all the time. The authors do the heavy lifting. All we have the easy part. Just buy the book. And this book, highly recommend it. Anyone that buys this baseball fans are going to love it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Gary Mack of the Mets Musings podcast. And if you like barbecue and you like baseball, then you have to listen to Baseball and BBQ with Jeff and Len. They always have the best guests from the world of baseball and the world of barbecue, all in one little package. So check it out. Baseball and BBQ with Len and Jeff. Okay, guys, take it away.
And thank you, Jonathan. Len, like I said before we started, that was a terrific book.
Yeah, it was a great book. You know, I want to just clear up what I was saying before. When I say, you know, second baseman on the Twins and who's just, you know, average or whatever. But that average player, you've got somebody who had to scout him. And that average player on the Twins may have been the best player in his whole high school, in his whole town, in his whole area. And these guys somehow are able to pick that out. That is really just amazing.
Usually, you know, they're the best players in a county or in a region. But of course, you have those like Joe Gagliola, who lived across the street from Yogi Berra when he was a kid. He wasn't the best player on his block.
that's one of the best quotes of all. That's all right. Yeah, that's really that is really good. Jeff, you know what? We should tell everybody the holidays are here. This is coming out the day before Christmas or 2 days before Christmas. But maybe you didn't get what you wanted. I hope everybody gets what they want, but maybe you were looking at baseballbbq.com and you wanted that and nobody got it for you. So you know what you do? Get it for yourself. Go ahead. Treat yourself. Go to baseballbbq.com. Maybe somebody gave you a gift card for the holiday. You know, like obviously if it's a store, you can't use it. But I don't know, maybe they gave you a Visa gift card, American Express gift card. Maybe they gave you cash. Do you remember cash, Jeff?
No.
It's paper money. Yogi used to say it's as good as money or something like that. What was his quote that he said in the
and they give you cash, which is just as good as money.
Right. So head to baseballbbq.com. They've got amazing grilling tools and accessories and treat yourself. Okay. Start the year off right.
And if you want to reach the show, give us a call at 516-855-8214. Email us, baseballandbbq@gmail.com. Leave a comment on our Facebook page, Baseball and BBQ. We have an X or Twitter at Baseball and BBQ. Instagram, Baseball and Barbecue, where barbecue is all spelled out. Our website is www.baseballandbbq.weebly.com. And please rate, review, do all that fun stuff.
Subscribe, tell all your friends.
Len, do you have something for us?
It's time for the barbecue quote of the week.
Jeff, this isn't an actual quote, but it's barbecue wisdom. So if I can impart some wisdom as we get ready to enter the new year, not yet, but soon enough. Amateurs practice until they get it right. Professionals practice until they can't get it wrong.
Very good.
I have no idea who said it because it doesn't say. I like this one. All right, I'm going to give a bonus. Here's a bonus since there's no names attributed to it. If I am on fire, this is not a training exercise. Please extinguish. Okay.
You know, you're a funny guy. You're a funny guy. And you know what else is funny?
Your segue. You know what, Jeff? You're good. You're very good, you. You know, yes, Dave Williamson. He's very funny. He's Meet Dave. Meet Dave, he goes all around the country doing his comedy. He does his podcasts. He's smoking in his front yard in California, smoking barbecue. And he was a great guest. We're so happy that he came on with us. So Dave Williamson, come on down. So Jeff, I'm going to start this off a little differently. All right, I got a riddle for you. What do you get when you combine a barbecue lover and a podcaster? Put them in a little test tube and you put them in the lab. What do you get?
I think we got our next guest. And who is that, Leonard?
That is none other than Dave Williamson. He's also known as Meet Dave. And he was once billed as the best comedian in Miami, Florida. His next goal, and he may have actually achieved that, is to be the funniest man in barbecue. And we are very, very pleased to welcome to the Baseball and Barbecue Podcast none other than Dave Williamson, or as Meet Dave.
Yeah, what's up, guys? Thanks for having me. And yeah, that was actually very literal. I was created in a test tube just like that. There was a little bit of a brisket grease in there, and and a little bit of punchlines being told, and they mixed it up, and then here I am.
Yeah. All right. So, Dave, thanks for joining us. Yeah, as Len said, you're originally from Florida, but now you reside in California.
Yeah, I grew up in Miami, Florida, and I started comedy there. And then I moved out to L.A. about 10 years ago. Time flies. You know, back then, everyone told you had to go to L.A. or New York. It was like the thing you had to do. You know, it's like if you wanted to be serious about comedy and be in the entertainment industry, at some point they're like, you're going to outgrow your scene. You got to go. Now you could do it from anywhere. Like, people are doing comedy and have entertainment careers from all kinds of different markets. Now, it still helps to be in L.A. or New York, you know. Yeah. And we like our community where we live. And, you know, I'm able to have four smokers in my front yard and cook for my neighbors and throw some pretty mean barbecues. So, you know, I'm happy we live out there. And there's a lot of advantages to live in L.A. But, you know, Nashville, Austin, Texas, Denver, all amazing comedy scenes now. Or you could podcast or do YouTube and kind of have success from anywhere.
Right, right. So what kind of smokers do you have out in front of your house?
Oh, let me tell you about them. So I've definitely evolved over, you know, I've been really big into Texas style barbecue for about maybe 7 years now, I would say. And man, I started with just this cheap smoker I bought at, I was going on the road, you know, I'd go on the road and I'd do gigs in Texas, and I'd always loved barbecue my whole life. But when I go on the road, it doesn't matter where I'm at, I try to find the best barbecue restaurant in town, you know, or somewhere I wanted to go for lunch with. And when I go to Texas, it just blew my mind. I mean, you guys know how great barbecue is in Texas. Oh, yeah. And I'd go back to LA and I'd get so mad. I'd be like, man, I go, why can't we get good barbecue like that? I'm going to teach myself. And so I bought an offset smoker, just a cheap one from Home Depot. And that has now turned into, I have a custom made about a 230 gallon, beautiful Miami blue. It's about this color. Offset smoker that SG Metalworks made for me with my Meet Dave logos on it and everything. It's a beautiful offset smoker. And then I have quite a few Rectex. You know, people want to knock the pellet grills, but there's a time and a place for all different kinds of smokers. So, you know, I got really into using the pellet smokers when we were on the tour bus, and I could just pull it out and I could smoke when we're on the road, you know, outside the comedy club, outside a theater. And so I have a 1250 from Rectech. I have another 1250, I think, from Rectech that they sent me to beta test one time. And then I have a bullseye from them. I have a pizza oven in my front yard now that I like to cook on. I got a big green egg mini max now. I have a lot of smokers and grills in my yard.
Nice.
And they're all in the front yard?
Yeah. So, you know, LA, man, LA, we don't have big yards in most places, most parts of town. LA, you know, you're very on top of each other. And our house has a cute little front yard, a cute little backyard. So the kids have the backyard. I built a barn for them back there. They have the clubhouse. They got their basketball hoop. They got their soccer net in the backyard. Front yard's for Papa. I got my hammock up there. I built my barbecue, you know, little shack. You know, I got my cool little like wooden thing that I built. And I got all my smokers lined up out front. And I built a big walled. I put a 65 inch TV on in my fire pit area. So, man, when the smoke's rolling out of my smoker and the TV's on, all my neighbors know, man, they come over and they call it the compound. All the neighbors come over and hang out in my front yard.
Of course. Yeah.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah. If I see this in the front yard and I'm driving by all of a sudden, excuse me, sir, my car seems to have broken down and I see you're cooking. Do you mind?
Oh, well, you know, the thing I was worried about, too, is if I put my smoker in the backyard and people just see smoke coming up, they're going to call the fire department thinking that a house is on fire. So if it's in the front yard, they can see me and they know I'm out there cooking and they're like, oh, all right, it's just Dave. And then, you know, I make sure I keep everybody fed so nobody complains about it.
Nice. Now in California, I guess the tri-tip is the big meat, right?
Tri-tip is really central to Central California. Yeah, that's a big part of their barbecue culture. It's gotten a lot more popular all around the country. It was funny.
Yeah.
When I first started cooking tri-tip a few years ago, absolutely fell in love with making tri-tip. It was pretty cheap, and it was expensive other parts of the country because a lot of places didn't carry it. So it was a supply and demand, Tri-tip's now become pretty mainstream everywhere and popular. And I don't know why, but tri-tip's like expensive where we're at now. And it's pretty affordable in other parts of the country. But I love, man, tri-tip, no matter what, man, one of the best bangs for your buck. So easy to cook, you don't have to plan it like the night before, like you do with a brisket or a lot of other beef and pork. Tri-tip, you just trim it up real clean, I don't leave any silver skin in. I don't leave any fat on it, where a lot of other stuff, you got to leave some fat so it renders or whatever. Tri-tip, man, I just clean it up nice and neat. And then I just smother it in some sort of Santa Monica seasoning, or I'll put my seasoning on it, Meat Dave Rub. And then you reverse sear it in the smoker to a nice medium rare. Yeah, my family loves it when I make tri-tip.
So, Dave, we have to do the obligatory, and as a podcaster, you know this, we have to find out, your origin story. So tell us, you weren't born a comedian, although you might have been one of you might have in school. Were you the class clown? Where'd the love of barbecue come from? And then where did the comedian, where you're now doing that as a career, come from?
Well, I think they both came from, the early days. Yeah, the class clown stuff, of sure. I never had a desire to cook. Like, cooking wasn't something that was on my radar. But I did enjoy big family meals. My parents would always invite everyone over, just like my front yard is now. Man, I was an only child, but my house was always full of neighbors and friends. And so I would always watch my mom hold court. She's a very good storyteller, and my grandma as well. And I would just see them exaggerate. Every time they tell the story got a little bigger and a little more fine-tuned, And so I always really appreciated that. And I think that's really affects my style of comedy now. I'm more of a storyteller on stage. So I enjoyed being the class clown. I enjoyed getting attention, of course. I enjoyed being funny. And I think it's just in my core. I like to make people happy. And when I stumbled on comedy as a hobby, I just really loved having a creative outlet that just made people so, happy, like in a very direct way. Because I was freelance writing. I was freelance writing for a local newspaper. And I'd always try to make my articles kind of funny. And when I wrote for a student paper in school at Auburn University, who's got a very good baseball program, by the way.
Yeah.
I'd always try to make funny articles, And then, but when you're writing stuff like that, you write it, you give it to an editor, they change it. It goes to print. Maybe a week later, you run into somebody who read it, and then they give you their feedback and they're like, hey man, I liked your article. With stand up, it's like, I was thinking of something on the way to the show, I just said it and people gave me instant feedback on whether that was actually funny or not, or they appreciated it or not. And it was just such a more instant gratification. I fell in love with stand-up. I lived in Miami after school and in business with my father. My father's in the car business, and I'd go do open mics. I'd take my tie off and throw on a shirt and run to the improv to do open mics for years and years and years. Just was a hobby that slowly became my career. And then barbecue didn't come in until much later, because I always loved eating barbecue. There was this place, every college campus has a, the place that you remember and had a big impact on you, whether it's a sub shop or chicken wings or a barbecue place. I had all three at Auburn, Mama Goldberg's Deli, Willie's Wings, and Byron's Smokehouse. Changed my life. Those three places. The Byron Smokehouse, I found it at Auburn, and I was like, dude, I ate there three or four times a week with my water polo teammates. I played water polo at Auburn, and it just became part of our culture, man, eating at Byron's. And then when I started traveling around the country doing comedy, that was part of why I love barbecues. I was like, oh, I want to find the Byron's all around the country, And then I got mad that day and I was like, you know what? I'm going to teach myself how to do this because I'm sick of not being able to get good barbecue. And now there's some better barbecue around LA. But back then, the only good barbecue you get was the guys who were doing it themselves and popping up at like breweries and stuff. So I started to become friends with those guys. And then I realized having my I started the podcast, and it was a great little scam. Because now when I was going and looking for these restaurants around the around the country, I would just hit them up and go, yo, I have a barbecue podcast called Meet Dave. And I'd like to meet your pitmaster and interview him. And I just wanted to learn, you know, I was just asking questions, how to do stuff. And then, you know, I'd get to know the guy and I'd get usually a free lunch out of it. I started becoming friends with all these barbecue people. So I started really appreciating what goes into it and the culture of barbecue, just how great barbecue people are. So, I mean, it was just, once again, barbecue, just like my comedy career, was a hobby that just became so much more, you know?
Yeah.
I thought we were the only ones who knew that secret, Len, going around to barbecue places saying we had a podcast.
I know.
Yeah. Cats out of the bag, fellas.
Yeah, I know, right? So, Dave, we were turned on to you by one of your former guests that we had on, Robin Lindars. And said, I had such a fun time on Dave Williamson's podcast. So I said, I checked it out and then I contacted you. And so how did you get started with the podcast? And I'm looking at your list of great guests here. I mean, Heath Riles, Blazing Star, who we had on also, Mike Starr. I mean, you had a great lineup of guests.
Yeah. I mean, it literally started. So here's the thing. I would go out to the comedy clubs when I first started getting really into barbecue. And I look back at these photos now and I'm like embarrassed by them. But, you know, I was like, dude, I made these ribs. And I was like so proud. And I put it up on Instagram, you know. And I go out to the comedy clubs to hang out and do sets around L.A. And where normally people would have the same generic conversations night in, night out, where it's like, oh, what's up, man? You've been on the road lately. Are you going to do a set tonight? You know, what, you know, blah, 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 blah. Shop talk. All anybody wanted to talk to me about was barbecue. They're like, dude, I saw you posted ribs. Like, yeah, man. And like, I didn't even know you could do that in Los Angeles. Like, do you have like a real smoker? And did it? And so I was really having fun, like teaching people about it, you know, even though I was barely an expert at the time, you know, it was new to me too. But I just came up with this idea one day where I just made a fake logo that said Meet Dave. And I posted on my Instagram and I said, would anybody listen if I started a barbecue podcast? And man, I had so many comments on that. People were like, that would be amazing. They're like, I love the name. What a great name. That's the perfect name for you. You know, everyone loves hanging out with you and you go meet people. And I don't know. I just got such good feedback from it. I go, I think I should do this. So I just started doing it. And the funny thing is I couldn't believe, whereas comedians have been doing podcasts since like the beginning for so long and they do so many podcasts. I think that at some point, like a lot of comedians are jaded about like, hey man, will you do my podcast? And like, oh man, I've got so many podcasts this week and all about comedy, you know, barbecue people. It was new to them. So I'd reach out to some of the bigger name guys who I wanted to meet and be like, hey man, I'm going to be in your city doing comedy. I'd love to talk to you about your barbecue. And they were like, oh man, thank you for showing an interest. Yeah, I would love that. And I'll come to your comedy show. And so I just became fast friends with a lot of those guys, you know? And it was cool. Like, I really admire a lot of them. And I'd been doing such a deep dive on watching YouTube and reading books. And I mean, I looked up during the pandemic, found every old barbecue show that was on a streaming service that I could find and just watched it all. I watched like all the old Pitmasters and, you know, all those barbecue brawls and whatever. And so a lot of those guys, I just became fans, you know, and I just hit them up on Instagram. I was like, hey, man, I'd love to interview you. And just so many of them were kind and gracious with their time and have become very good friends.
Yeah, that's how people in barbecue are, because it's amazing how the same with us. You know, we've been doing this for 6 years and it's just the guests that we've had. They're incredible. How they give their time and the events that we've gone to. You know, you mentioned food and comedy. Those, two things that, as people are filling their stomach with great food, you know, it's something they love. Comedy, they love. So those are two great things that go together.
Yeah. Well, and I keep trying to find more and more ways to, like, combine the worlds. When I work at a comedy club, a lot of times I'll borrow a smoker from someone in that city and set it up outside the comedy club and I'll cook, you know, brisket or pork butts or whatever. And then they'll put it on their menu. You know, if comedy clubs usually already sell quesadillas are already sell nachos. So now they just put my pulled pork on top of the nachos. And they're like, dude, we've never sold this many nachos before, you know? Right. Or I sell my own all-purpose seasoning and rub. And they'll use it on the specialty drinks. They'll make like a spicy margarita with the rub on the rim, something like that. Yeah, it's really fun to figure out different ways to combine the two worlds. I went and I did a 2-month tour where I did comedy in barbecue restaurants when everything was starting to open back up after the pandemic. And I mean, it was awesome. I was going to go for like a week, and then I had so many people interested. I went for 2 months and went all the way from, I drove from LA to Boston and back. And did shows all along the way.
Nice. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because when you were doing those shows, people were still wearing masks, though, right, in the clubs?
Yeah, in the club. I mean, you know, most of the places, I was around more of the barbecue folk.
Gotcha. Right. Okay. They weren't wearing masks.
Yeah. I mean, you know, look, it's at that point in time, it's a little different than being like, you know, if you're in a field in the middle of Ohio, it's not as big of a deal as
exactly.
Right. LA in a crowded club with everyone on top of you. You know?
Now, Dave, you answered the question, because I saw that you had another podcast that you were doing called the Tony Azevedo podcast. And it was the guy with the water polo. I was like, how does that? And I see that you're talking to a lot of guys in the sport and stuff. It's like, how is that? All right. I know the barbecue and I know you. So meet Dave, but how's that related? But now that you played water polo at Auburn, that makes sense.
Yeah, I played in college, and you know, I love water polo. I'm very passionate about it. It's a great sport, and I coach, and my son's a junior in high school now. We just won a CIF championship. That was a really neat experience, being able to jump in the water and celebrate with him a championship. You know, I guess like water polo, comedy, and barbecue are the three things that like I'm, you know, that's like who I am, you know. So anytime I combine any of those two things together, it's the best, you know? So I'll do it with water polo a lot too. The kids I coach, if they have like a really good game or win a tournament, I'll be like, yo, Friday is going to be Meet Dave barbecue day. And then they're like, yes. And then after practice, I pull out all the spread and they just go to town, you know? So yeah, I did water polo. I was doing the podcast with Tony Azevedo, who's like the Michael Jordan of USA water polo. We were doing that all through the pandemic because, you know, there was free time. And then I have another podcast with my buddy Forrest Shaw, who's another comedian. He's from Florida as well. So, you know, it's two comics that are just shooting the shit, really. But most of our stories or episodes end up being about something with our growing up in Miami or some crazy stuff that, you know, all the Florida man stuff.
Yeah. What's the name of that one?
So that's the Merman, because we both have aquatic backgrounds. He was a marine biologist, and you know, I have the water polo background. So it's the Merman podcast with Dave and Forrest Shaw. And then, you know, the Tony Azevedo podcast, we've been on hiatus, but I think we'll bring it back at some point. And then Meet Dave, M-E-A-T, Dave.
Now, Dave, you travel all over the place, so you get to experience barbecue in all the places. But I have to.
You like these hotel curtains behind me?
Yeah. you're in Vegas now, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm in Vegas this week and Winnipeg, Canada next week. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Okay. What happens there, we know, stays there, including those curtains. You can leave. Do not take those. Take a towel, but do not take the curtains, Dave.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, I happen to have heard you mention that Texas barbecue is your favorite, and you mentioned Texas barbecue. Is that still your favorite of all the, you know, the Carolinas, the, you know, wherever, Kansas City? Is Texas still the best?
I mean, Texas is my favorite style of barbecue. Yeah. And I mean, obviously they have so many barbecue restaurants there, and it's just so rich in their tradition. But I mean, it depends what specifically you're talking about, because I mean, if it's pulled pork, then I would say maybe Carolina. I love, you know, the Carolina, the gold sauce that they put on it. And they just really have a lot of passion in that. You know, maybe ribs. You might look at Memphis if you're like a dry rub guy. So, I mean, it just depends where you're at. You know, like you brought up the tri-tip. Dude, if you're up in San Juan Capistrano, or I'm sorry, San Luis Obispo, and you go to one of the real like old school legit tri-tip places, I mean, but yeah, Texas is the safest place to like go in and say, yo, give me one of everything, and just everything's going to be amazing. You know, I think it's so silly. that people argue about who's the best barbecue restaurant in Texas, because like they're all amazing. Like at that point, you're like grasping at straws, you know. Right. It's like the everyone's got the meat figured out. Like you might be able to have an argument on like, all right, we're going to bring sides into the equation. We're going to bring in sweet tea. We're going to bring in who's got the best patio to drink a cold beer on, the ambiance, like, you know, parking, all that stuff. But there's no losers, man. Like every barbecue joint's pretty damn good in Texas.
I listened to a couple of your podcasts. Did I hear right that you actually competed in a couple of contests?
Well, so I've been to quite a few competitions to kind of, you know, pal around, and I actually performed comedy at Memphis in May a couple of years ago, but I just competed in my first official contest, an event called the Rub and Tug down in Key West, Florida. Don't be scared off by the double entendre.
We actually heard of that. Yeah, we heard of that contest. Go ahead. Talk about it.
It was really cool, man. Bunch of people organized it, like the guys from W Sauce and Matt Pittman from Meat Church and a bunch of other sponsors, and people came together, and it was a fundraiser for pediatric cancer charity. And so it was an invitational. It was the first year they were doing it. So it was a fishing tournament, a lobster tournament, and then a barbecue competition all wrapped into one. They only invited somewhere like 15 to 20 teams, I think. And I was one of them. He called me up and said, do you want to, I figured he'd put me on someone else's team. Right. But he was like, do you want to captain your own team? And I was like, well, that'd be fun. I brought a couple buddies with me. I brought a Jody from Rack Tech. Cause I always like cooking with Jody, and we've done some content and some cooks together. And I brought Roy Bellamy, who's one of the producers on the Dan Le Batard show. Cause he's always I've known him for a long time. He's always talking about barbecue, and I thought he'd get a kick out of being there and be a good, he'd be a lot of help, but also would learn a lot and have fun from all the guys there. And then I brought my son, Owen. You know, my older son and I, like our connection is sports. My younger son and I, we cook barbecue together, and he helps me sell it at my shows and stuff like that. So he came, and he was a great help. So it was an awesome event, and we did really well at it, man. I couldn't believe these are all my barbecue heroes and stuff. But I think I might have got an edge because I'm pretty used to traveling and partying. So I made sure they were all partying really hard, you know? So I think I was a little fresher on day three of the cook than they are.
Big green eggs were actually in the water, that event?
Yeah, the lobster day, we went lobstering from 8 a.m. to noon. And then they had a whole party set up on the sandbar. And we get there, and there was like 20 big green eggs set up with tents and tables and whatever. And we sat there and cooked a steak and lobster, freshly caught lobster, and all kinds of proteins. And then just people came out on their boats, and we fed people for free, drinking beer, smoking cigars. And then the water started slowly coming up as the tide came up, and like people's buckets with supplies were like floating away. So yeah, by the end of the day, man, the water was up to our knees. And so the big green eggs were still there. We're still cooking on them, and they're just sitting in the ocean like that, man. It was so cool.
It's good that they're heavy.
That doesn't suck. I tell you, that doesn't suck. It sounded like a great event.
It was an amazing day.
Dave, I saw some of your comedy. I laughed a lot. And you're right. Yeah. Right. That would be bad. And Dave, I didn't laugh. No, I did. And I like, you're right. You tell the story. When I watch comedy, I don't care if the comedian's dirty or not. That doesn't bother me. It didn't matter that. Either way, but I notice your stories, at least the ones I watched, clean, you know, family humor. You talk a lot about, you know, you talked about being a dad. I loved the one you talked about. You were hiking and you're wearing the sweatshirt over, because I wanted to ask you, and you're talking about that, and then some guy gives you a hard time, and then you tell him, I'm looking for my son, he's lost.
Well, he's one of these guys that, like, you know, needed to be the center of attention, and I shouldn't get so mad at it, because I'm that guy a lot of the times too. But he came up real aggressive. I had my son's sweatshirt over my shoulders. And then the guy comes up and he's like, hey, buddy, looks like you bought that sweatshirt. It's a couple sizes too small. Ha ha. I'm being loud and punching me on the shoulder. And I was in a bad mood that day. And so, yeah, I decided to shut him down. And I just looked at him and I said, oh, no, man, that's not my sweatshirt. That belongs to my son. he's been missing for 2 days now. If you could keep your eyes open as you're hiking, we'd really appreciate that. And then this dude was like, oh, no. And it's funny because you said, like, I'm not really the dirtiest of comics, and I don't really trape in, like, too much of dark humor. But that's, like, a really, you know, dark joke. But it was something that really happened, and I was, you know, I'm just being honest that, like, even me, like, my comedy now is like a TED talk. Like, after the pandemic, like, I don't want to, like, talk about, like, negative stuff. I try to, like, be a little bit more uplifting and honest and vulnerable or whatever. And that one, though, is, you know, it was one of my dark days, and I'll share it with you. You know, I wasn't proud of it, but it was funny.
And I love how you didn't think your family would support you in that. And your son then says, he played along. They played along.
Yeah, they were looking in the bushes. They were like, Robbie. I was like, you gave this kid a name?
They named him, right. So, yeah. Because I was going to ask you, one of the things that, you know, Jeff and I, we've got right around our area, there's two big comedy clubs. Often, you know, hecklers. I wanted to ask you how you deal with hecklers. But I don't know if you get a lot of hecklers because your comedy doesn't seem to, but maybe it does. I don't know.
It's not really like hecklers. It's not really like people who aren't having fun and like are like mad or like trying to battle you. But there's like, no matter who you are, there's a lot of just disruptive people. And way more now than there used to be. Back in the day, it was like, there was like, it would happen every now and then. And then my reaction was usually just to ignore them. And then someone would come over and be like, hey, man, can you please keep it down? And then they'd be like, oh, yeah. And you'd move on, right?
Right.
If that doesn't work, then maybe then you address them and you put them in their place. But, yeah, man, like I try not to I try not to, like, rip someone unless they really won't stop and they really deserve it. And, like, you know, and then I'll prove to them that I'm better at this than they are, you know? You know, what's happened is comedians started videotaping their sets. And they found out that crowd work actually gets a lot of hits on TikTok and on, you know, Instagram reels and stuff like that. So everyone was like, the comedians were actually almost kind of encouraging a lot of crowd or like crowd interaction. And then they'd get some sort of a funny line and they'd snip it and they'd put it up on social media. And then now a lot of people think that's what being at a comedy show is supposed to be. So now a lot of people do yell out at comedy shows. So if I sense that, I actually have a joke about how comedians screwed ourselves with this thing. Like, you know, like, hey, we're going to sell tickets, but we're selling tickets to people who don't know how to behave at a comedy show. So, yeah, I mean, I just address it if I have to on stage. And normally once you get into your set and people are there to see you, they're pretty polite. But, yeah, it happens more now than ever. Let's put it that way.
And also, you also have a all-purpose seasoning and rub that you sell in there, right?
Yeah, it's super fun. I love it. I wasn't at a point where I would have ever been like, yo, I'm an expert, get my rub. But so many people messaged me and wanted like, yo, what'd you put on that? And I tell them my recipe. I'm like, oh, it's mostly salt and pepper and a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And people are like, where can I buy it? And I'm like, I don't sell it. Like, I just like literally go to the store and buy these ingredients. It's super simple. And then they're like, well, could you send me a link to some? And so I just realized people just want to buy it, you know? So I made one and it's been, I'm glad I did because it's been really, I sell them after my shows, you know, when I'm on the road and when people cook with them, or you can buy them on my website, davewilliamsoncomedy.com. And then when people cook with them, they usually tag me. And like, yo, I'll put Meat Dave on rub on this or whatever. And then it's cool for me to see what people are making with my seasoning, you know? And I specifically made it so you would enjoy it even if you're not a barbecue guy. So it's like, it's an all-purpose like seasoning where you can put it on your eggs in the morning, on steak, on chicken. I mean, I put it on salad. I put it on pizza. I put it on everything, right? Because it's got red pepper flakes in it. But then if you want to put it on your barbecue, like on a brisket, I would put it on as a layer. So I would make more like 80% mixture of like kosher salt and coarse pepper and like maybe 20% of my rub and then mix it all together and then put that on a brisket or on ribs or pork butt or whatever.
And you have a great label of for the package because it looks like a Miami setting. You're there with a beer and a microphone, just having fun. So,
yeah. I had to just I revamped the label. Yeah, that's the original label. Yeah, it's an old photo of me holding a big beer, and then they photoshopped I think a microphone in my hand or something. And it's super Miami. All my, I'm always wearing the Miami colors and repping Miami, even though I don't live there anymore. And then now, I had to do a little bit more of a cleaner label because we're going to start looking into going into, stores and stuff like that. So I just needed to make it a little cleaner, but it's still a fun label.
Yeah, definitely. I wanted to ask you before, I've two left for you. One is a barbecue related. I heard on your last podcast that in 2024, you're going to do plenty of barbecue comedy events. So you want to tell us where you're going and tell us the dates or whatever?
Yeah. I'm still, making stuff up as I go along with what's out there for barbecue and comedy together. Once a month, I have a show in my neighborhood in L.A. at El Segundo. And I put together these amazing lineups of my friends. I get really accomplished and famous comics to come do it. It's in a rock and roll venue. And everyone brings their own lawn chair, and they set up their lawn chair at 7 o'clock. And then at 7:30, I start serving barbecue. And then at 8 o'clock, we start the show. And it's like, I look forward to it every month. It's so fun. And that's, if you follow me on Instagram at Dave W Comedy, I'm always posting the flyers for it and the information. Mm-hmm. And then in January, I'm going to be in Tampa, and I'm doing a festival with Forrest Shaw with our Mermen podcast. We're gonna do a live taping and we're gonna do some comedy sets there. And then I'm trying to put together with some of my barbecue buddies in Florida that are influencers and stuff, and I was talking to Robin about it. So we're gonna try to do a barbecue tailgate on the Saturday of the festival. So we're just gonna bring in a bunch of smokers into the parking lot of the comedy club and just have a tailgate basically. And then I got a bunch of dates in 2024 with I'm going to be opening up for Bert Kreischer and a couple of his dates. And we always have the smoker with us. So we're out there cooking in the parking lot. I'm going to be, I can't think of a lot of my dates off the top of my head where I'm going to be, but anytime I'm at a comedy club or I'm somewhere, I try to find some way to combine the two worlds and bring barbecue into the mix. DaveWilliamsonComedy.com is where I post my tour dates normally, and or just follow me on Instagram at Dave W Comedy. And I'm constantly throwing them out there,
Great. And one other thing, you recently came back from a cruise where you placed second in a belly flop contest. Second. Who did you lose to?
So the cruise was Bert Kreischer's Fully Loaded Comedy Tour, and they sold out the whole cruise ship. It was amazing. And I hosted the belly flop and the Speedo contest on that. But the second place finish that you're talking about was actually at the Rub and Tug down in Key West. Yeah, I would trust me. Everyone was very upset. Everyone was like, I can't believe that you got robbed of that title, because I had my USA Speedo that I busted out. I took W Sauce, who is the main sponsor. It's Worcestershire sauce, and I rubbed it all over my body, and I laid out a nice belly flop. But I guess some other big guy, they just thought technically his belly flop was a little bit better. And I'm like, well, come on, man. You got to give style points here. I think the style points are important.
Dave, multiple podcasts, you're touring, you got the rub, you're cooking, you got a family. Do you ever sleep?
Nope. That's when we were winning CIF championships, the time I should have been sleeping. We got to go out there and work hard, boys.
Well, I have to tell you, you've been great. I did want to ask you one thing. As I was watching the comedy, and there were a couple of people, and I saw one person on Colbert it was interesting. I'm watching you, and then it goes to, I watch you on YouTube, and then the next thing, before I got a chance to change it, this guy, I forget his name even, was on Colbert, and made me think about when Jeff and I were kids, right? Comedians, they performed in the clubs, right? I think clubs were smaller at the time. Some of them were on TV. The big thing was going on if they got their big break on Carson or Letterman, right? Now, comedians, this is how you're making your living, right? What are the big things now for a comedian, like to the different levels of comedy?
Well, the easy answer, I think, of what you're alluding to, like the things that will help like make you I mean, Rogan is the new Carson. You know, if you get on Joe Rogan's podcast and you have a great appearance, then that's the kind of thing that can, you know, shoot you up the ranks, just like being on Carson was back in the day. Creating your own content, finding an audience. You don't have to be on a TV show anymore. You don't have to have someone else do it for you. If you can just figure out some way to find your own audience, then that's huge, you know? And barbecues, that it's kind of what it's just accidentally and authentically become for me, because a lot of the people that come out to my shows are people that know me from the barbecue world and are connecting me from that. And, you know, the other thing is Netflix, obviously. You know, not everyone in the world is going to get a Netflix special right out the gate. And what a lot of people are doing now is just putting their own specials up on YouTube. And if you put a good product out there, like your people will find it. And that's kind of an exciting time right now for comedy, man. Comedy is really booming.
People need to laugh. Really,
yeah. People are really connecting with, it's allowing the comics to do bigger venues and bigger things. Yeah. It's neat.
And also, you failed to mention, but I'm sure you were thinking of it, appearing on the Baseball and Barbecue podcast.
100%. This is my big break. Yeah.
There you go. So we're glad to help. Dave, we thank you so much for coming on. You really added class to a classless show, and we do appreciate that. So thank you very much. We will watch you. We're looking forward to maybe your tour takes you through New York at some time.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking to come to New York sometime this year. I was literally just telling my wife, I got to find a week or two to go do spots in New York. It's been too long. So I'll definitely hit you guys up if I'm up that way.
All right. Fantastic. Yeah, we have governors over here on Long Island. You have Caroline to New York City. So, yeah, plenty of places to
we have the brokerage. The brokerage.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
And then we'll go eat some barbecue.
There you go.
Jeff will make you some barbecue. Come on.
Yeah. Oh, really? Dave, thank you very much. Go to DaveWilliamsFromComedy.com or on Instagram, Dave W Comedy. Follow Dave. Great follow. Listen to his podcast. We really appreciate you joining us, Dave.
You got it. And I just started a barbecue specific Instagram. So I just started putting stuff up there. And that's @MeatDaveBarbecue.
@MeatDaveBarbecue. Check it out, guys.
Yep. Okay. Got it.
You know what? I want to ask you one more thing. This is, podcasts are meant to break rules. There are no rules in podcasting.
No, we're just laid back guys.
Traveling all around the country, baseball at all? Go to any baseball games or?
I love going to Cubs games. You know, I'm not a huge baseball fan. I rooted for the Marlins in Miami, and then they left bad taste in our mouth a lot of times, you know, with the fire sales and the team or whatever. So I really appreciate baseball, and I love just sporting events in general, but I love going to the historic, places like Wrigley Field. Mm-hmm. And I got to take I was doing shows at the Chicago Improv. I brought my family with me, and I got to bring my boys to see a game at Wrigley, which was really cool. What was the neater though, was the first Fully Loaded tour that I got to do with Bert. And I should have led with this because this is so up your guys' alley. I got to host the whole festival, and the festival was taking place in minor league ballparks around the country. So I was actually running a tailgate, giving free barbecue away to the fans for like 2 hours before the show. And then I would run up to the stage and I would host a 4-hour show that was outdoors in a ballpark. And then I would run back and I would break down all my barbecue stuff and put it on the bus. So I'd go to the after party, and then I'd, be drunk and walk over to the bus freezer and figure out what I'm going to cook the next day and pull it out so it would defrost. And then I'd get up at 8 a.m. the next day and I'd see, how much time do I have to get this barbecue cooked? And I did that for, the whole summer, man. It was a blast.
That's fantastic. Nice. That's fantastic.
Now we can wrap.
There you go.
Thanks, Dave, for joining us.
All right, guys. Take it easy, man. We'll see you soon.
You too. Okay.
Thank you.
And thank you, Dave, for joining us. He is a funny guy. He's a comedian, he's a pitmaster. He's from Florida, but now lives in California. And if you can go see him and do his comedy, I recommend it.
Highly recommend it. It is not easy to make a career doing comedy, but he's somebody that's doing it. As we end our show, we should tell everyone that we are presented by Bet Online. It is where the game starts. But we're not starting. We're ending.
With the poet.
Shel Krakowski.
And the musician.
Dave Dresser.
And the song.
Baseball always brings you home.
We'll see you next week on episode 218.